Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our second Not Anymore a Parish Share on Megillat Esther. And I kind of want to switch, move rapidly forward in the story. So last week we saw, and what we did last week was we paid careful attention to the structure of the first chapter of Megillat Esther and how it very much sets up the two different perspectives on Achashverosh that we are kind of somewhat familiar with, the idea of Achashverosh as the grand, powerful king, ruler of a mighty nation. And yet, as we start to read the description of Achashverosh as it goes further, the first few narratives that we encounter reveal a very different Achashverosh and very much, if not the blundering, buffoonish Achashverosh, that then nonetheless, definitely a different Achashverosh than the beginning of the Megillah portrays, and he himself likes to portray. I want to move forward, and we're going to be looking at chapters 5 and 6 today. And there is going to be, again, if you attended the Esther Shiurim last year, the Tuesday night Shiurim, there's going to be a little bit of overlap, but still slightly different. But I want to start looking at chapters 5 and 6, mainly because If we didn't move forward in the story, we'd never actually learn some of the later chapters of Megillat Esther. Because if we learned chapter 1 last week, this week we would have focused on chapter 2. Next week we would focus on chapter 3, and there you go. It's done. And this is always a general... this is maybe a strange thing to encourage people to do. But sometimes it is good to read things out of order. Sometimes it is a positive thing to focus on a later point in the story. The same with as we come up to Pesach and you're reading a Haggadah. If you start reading your Haggadah on page 1, then realistically, unless you are, you know, efficient about reading, you might not actually get to some of the other stuff later in this, in the Haggadah. So sometimes it's good to pick a point at random and start again. Oh, happy birthday, Esther. I did know it was your birthday. As we are focusing on the Esther of the Megillah, may it in many ways, you know, also be a tribute to you, even though the kind of the Esther we are about to be analyzing, who is a very politically astute, and I don't want to use the term conniving, but like, as we're about to see, Esther is very, we are not painting you with the same brush as we are about to describe Esther of Tanakh, but nonetheless, yes, the poetic overlap is very good. So there you go. Happy birthday. And so with this, I want to turn to chapter 5 and I'm going to share my screen. And once again, we're just looking at the text of the Megillah as it's found on Sfaria. If you are unacquainted with Sfaria, this is a reminder to be acquainted with Sfaria because it truly is an excellent resource. With just so many things these days translated into English, it's really wonderful. So chapter 5. So at the end of chapter 4, is when we've had the very fascinating conversation between Mordechai and Esther. Basically, Esther, you need to do something. Esther's reluctant to do something. She tells the people fast, you know, all the rest. And so chapter 5 begins with Esther about to approach Achashverosh. It's a very famous, again, most parts of the Megillah are pretty well known, but again, this is a scene that I think is particularly well known. And we read the very beginning of chapter 5. Vayhi bayom hashlishi, on the third day, vatilbash Esther malchut, she puts on her royal apparel, vata'amod b'chatzar beit hamelech, ha'pnimit nochach beit hamelech, v'hamelech yoshev al kisei malchuto b'beit hamelchut, nochach petach habayit. So Achashverosh is staring at the entrance. He sees Esther, verse 2, he extends his golden scepter. And she approaches, verse 3, vayomer la'hamelech, the king Achashverosh asks, so what's the problem? Malach Esther hamalka. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom, it shall be granted you. Let's pause there and analyze this very, very strange opening gambit from Achashverosh. So again, let's refresh our memories. Esther has said in the previous chapter that there is a rule in Persia that you're not actually allowed to approach the king unless summoned. And it's definitely true for the king's wife slash all the members of his harem. You only get to go to the king if the king wants to see you. And Esther is terrified to just approach Achashverosh to kind of make his request to plead on behalf of her people. And that's why she's giving Mordechai the resistance to doing this. But fine, he persuades her, she agrees to do it. So from our perspective, we enter chapter 5, terrified for Esther. She is sticking her neck out on the line. And the this first verse really kind of extends the drama of the moment. It really prolongs the tension. We get very clear descriptions of what's happening. You know, she's facing the king. The king is facing. Again, I'm not. Sometimes, you know, one can lean a little bit too much into the literary quality of things. But as I've mentioned last week, Esther is really blatantly, clearly literary. And it's, you know, we're prolonging the tension here. And fine, in the second verse, we learn that she has won his favor. So now we are thinking, assuming again, we don't already know the story. We've spoken before about the challenge of what's called the omniscient or omniscient reader. The fact that you know what's going to happen kind of numbs you to the tension in the story. But if we forget we know what's happening, we enter chapter 5 terrified for Esther. And okay, she wins the favor. Nasachin be'inav, as verse 2 tells us, Ahasuerus is, you know, breaks the Persian protocol and he allows Esther to enter. What is striking is the bizarre power dynamic at play. Everything leading up to chapter 5 has made it very clear that Ahasuerus is the mighty king of whom Esther is terrified. And she is, we assume, about to come in pleading, begging, crying for Ahasuerus to do something. And yet that entire perspective is subverted the moment Ahasuerus opens his mouth. Malach Esther Hamalka Uma Bakashatech Ad Chatzia Malchut V'inatein Lach. What is your request? What troubles you? Even if you want half the kingdom, I'll give it you. This is not the statement of someone who is particularly secure. This is not the statement of someone who is on the powerful side of the power dynamic. It speaks panic. We maybe have all been there. We've all been in these sorts of situations where we have a conversation with someone. And because we ourselves are so nervous, we betray our hand. And sometimes we betray our hand because we perceive ourselves to be on the wrong end of this power dynamic. We go into chapter 5, assuming Esther must beg Ahasuerus, but Ahasuerus's opening comment is to beg Esther. This is interesting because I should also stress again in verse 4, Esther points out she's not seen Ahasuerus in a while. He's not called for her. She understands that to be an indication of his displeasure with her, or at least his lack of enthusiasm for her. But now, verse 3, for whatever reason, again, it's not clear in the text what's happening. Ahasuerus is, for some reason, insecure. For some reason, concerned. He wants to, he worries Esther is so upset that he's willing to give her, you know, half the kingdom. In other words, he is so desperate to placate her unhappiness, despite the fact that we don't know what the source of this unhappiness is. You know, he'll divide his kingdom and make her queen over half of it. Again, that is a very, very poor opening negotiating gambit. So our Esther comment, she knows that Vashti was killed. So yeah, so that I think lends again to our sense of terror on behalf of Esther. She is nervous. She is upset. She's primarily upset because the Jews have been decreed to be exterminated. But yeah, again, it only ramps up. We know, we read in chapter 1, just how easily angered Ahasuerus is with his wives. We know how willing he is to just lop off the heads of people who displease him. a recurring theme that will also happen later in the Megillah, with Haman being impaled because Achashverosh is angry at him. And so Esther is terrified. But what we actually read in verse 3 is that for some reason unknown to us, Achashverosh is insecure. And then Esther makes a really interesting request of Achashverosh. Vatoma Esther imal ha-melech tov. Yavo ha-melech v'haman hayom el ha-mishteh asher asiti lo. Let Achashverosh and Haman come today to a feast. This is bizarre. Esther, the queen of Persia, is asking not just for a special audience with Achashverosh himself, but also for the sake of, but not just for Haman, but not just for Achashverosh, but also for Haman. Now, again, if we digest this and we think about this from a political perspective, this is a really interesting thing to do. This is a very strange thing to do. Why is Esther inviting Haman? Okay, Haman is second in command. He's a very important political person, but it seems to be a very interesting move for Esther to make. She doesn't just want to meet Achashverosh. She wants to have and she doesn't want to have a feast with Achashverosh and his courtiers in general. She wants to highlight, along with Achashverosh, the importance, the significance of Haman. What happens? So Achashverosh is like, sure, summons Haman to go too. And again, at the feast, verse 6, Vayomer HaMelech LeEsther B'Mishteh HaYayin, Ma She'ilatech V'Inatinach, what's your wish? I will grant it to you. By the way, note the Umava Kashatech Ad Chatzi HaMalchut Vateas. What is your request? Even to half the kingdom, it shall be filled. It shall be fulfilled. Note the placement here of the phrase V'Yinatin Lach in verse 6, verses verse 3. Achashverosh is even more desperate to placate Esther for whatever reason. He's even more willing to fulfill her wishes by basically saying, at this point, it's even more clear it's a blank check. What is your wish? It shall be granted to you. What's your request? Even if you're going to ask for something as extreme, it shall be fulfilled. And to Lavi's point that you could read verse 3 as posturing in front of assumingly his courtiers. So, again, I think I mentioned this last week. I should stress this. There are 15,000 different ways to read Esther, each of them legitimate. And just because one view conflicts with another does not delegitimize the other view. But I do think the fact that Achashverosh repeats with an even greater sense of urgency in verse 6 in private this same perspective really bespeaks a level of something going on. Verse 7, and again, to pay attention to the literary drama going on here, Vata'an Esther Vatomar, She'ilati uvakashati. You know, and we see in the English, they put a nice little dash, an M dash after this. My wish, my request. It's almost like it's a statement. It ratchets up again a little bit. If this were a play or a musical or an opera, this would, you know, the fact that it's its own verse would be its own like moment. And then she says, I want to do another feast with Haman and Achashverosh. Bizarre. She sings. Let's restate what we've said. Esther goes in terrified, but I'm guessing with some sort of plan. Again, we are not privy to what's going on, but she goes in terrified, assuming the power dynamic is Achashverosh Esther. And for whatever reason, that power dynamic shifts the moment Achashverosh says, whatever you want, I will give you. And at this point, Esther asks Achashverosh to come to a party with Haman. She introduces a third person into the political power calculus of Persia by equating Ahasuerus and Haman, by putting them both on the same level. It's not just Ahasuerus with whom the queen wants to meet, but also Ahasuerus's supposed number two, who now apparently is also getting a private invitation to spend time with the king and queen at the queen's request. And at that meal, Ahasuerus once again repeats his do whatever you want, it's cool, all for her to say, Haman, again, let's equate Haman and Ahasuerus. And we know the political ramifications of that because the final part of chapter 5 is Vayetze Haman Bayomahu Samech V'Tov Lev. Haman is thrilled. Okay, he gets annoyed when he sees Mordechai. I don't want to focus on that right now. But the point is that, again, Haman, the show-off, verse 11, tells all of his family about how great and glorious he is. And let's focus on verses 11 and 12, actually, because this is important. Vaisapelohem Haman et kvod oshrov rov banav. He shows off his wealth, his family members, you know, his fertility. He shows it to all the people. Ve'et kol asher gidlo hamelech ve'et asher nis'or, how the king had promoted him and advanced him, al hasarim ve'avdei hamelech, over all the rest, he's the most powerful non-royal person in the land. Vayomer Haman, af lo hevia Esther Amalka im hamelech lemishtar she'asaki im oti. And furthermore, you want to know how really powerful and amazing I am? Queen Esther has invited me and the king to no one else, just the two of us. I am, and again, and tomorrow, v'gam l'macharini kurula im hamelech, I'm going back again. In other words, it's not now Esther and Ahasuerus, Haman and all the courtiers, but that placement of Haman in the quote-unquote organizational chart of the Persian people, he's being elevated to close in his mind what he is taking from these meals, and what Esther is seeking out to achieve is the elevation of Haman closer to Ahasuerus. Why? What's the purpose? So it is one way to argue this that I think, you know, emerges from the text itself is Esther is playing off Ahasuerus's own insecurities coupled with Haman's own ambition. And these are two aspects that are very explicitly telegraphed in chapter 6. So at this point, chapter 5 ends with basically the plan to, you know, specifically kill Mordechai. But chapter 6 begins. Balayla hahu nidadashnat hamelech. The king can't sleep. Now, why can't he sleep? Why is his sleep disturbed? He's a little confused, I'd argue, as to what is going on between Esther and Haman and Ahasuerus. What on earth is happening within his own political power base to be placing, to be elevating Haman, you know, closer to him? Why is Esther wanting to have these special meetings just with Esther, Ahasuerus, and Haman? So fine, so then we get, so it's very, very interesting. So verse 1, 2, 3, he has the records brought out. And again, this is where the plot comes back to roost from the end of chapter 2. Mordechai, we learned, had foiled an assassination. But at this point, we are reminded, Ahasuerus can't sleep. And he gets read to him the assassination attempts made on him. He is read. What is read for him is the frailty of his seat. That he actually sits somewhat, you know, subject to assassination attempts. Two of the people who you know, Mishomrei Hasaf, some of what exactly, who God of the threshold. We'd spoken at length in the series last year about kind of how this all fits with the Persian palace. But in other words, these are two of his, again, the term secret service is maybe a little too grand, but these are two people who had access to Ahasuerus attempting to assassinate him. In other words, when the king can't sleep, he's a little bit worried what's going on. And the story read to him is the fact that this guy called Mordechai had foiled an attempt by two of the people closest to Ahasuerus who had tried to kill him. And all the while swirling in his head is the fact that Haman, his number two, something's iffy with that. In the Hebrew, and in the text as a whole, there is this absolutely jarring moment that, again, really, if this were a play, it would be, we kind of have to read this almost as a play. So the king asks, you know, Mana asayikad v'lala Mordechai alza, what's been happening with, has Mordechai been given any reward? Vayomaruna are hamelech, still in verse 3, Misharatav, his advisors respond to him, lo na'asa imo dava. Nothing has been done for Mordechai. Vayomer hamelech mivachatze. At that point, the king asks, who is in the courtyard? Now, this is, it's nighttime. It's bedtime. The king should be asleep. In other words, it's some point in the evening when everyone should be asleep. And Ahasuerus is not just randomly asking who happens to be knocking about the court at this point. I think it's far more. He heard, you know, he heard the classic clang of pots. You know, he heard a dog bark. He's just heard. Ahasuerus is, to use a very 21st century term, bit, you know, from verses 1, 2, 3, Ahasuerus is triggered. He can't sleep. Something is up. Something strange is happening with Esther and Haman. He's just trying to fall asleep. He's just been reminded of all his assassination attempts, all the times people have tried to kill him. He is triggered. And at that moment, he hears a rustling in the courtyard. He hears someone coming into the palace. Vayomer ha-melech mivachatzer. Someone's in the court. Who's in the court? And it tells us, Vahaman ba, lachatzar beit hamelech chitzona. Haman had just entered the outer court of the royal palace. He really wants to speak to Ahasuerus about his idea to kill Mordechai. Again, Ahasuerus's own suspicion and Haman's ambition are dovetailing with each other, ultimately to lead to Haman's downfall. Haman is so determined to kill Mordechai, he hates him so much, that at 11 o'clock at night, he's waking up the king, because again, it's bedtime for the king. Imagine if the king isn't awake. Haman is so desperate to tell Ahasuerus about his plan that he basically wants to wake him. That is the actions of someone who's a little bit too swept up in their own, you know, in their own stuff. Right? That's what's happened. Verse 5, he's told it's Haman. And this is when the king says, and this is an important point that I think we dwelt on again in last year's series. Vayavo Haman. Haman enters. Vayomer lo hamelech. The king asks him, Ma la'asot ba'ish asher hamelech chafetz bikara? What should be done for a man whom the king desires to honor? Now we know the person Ahasuerus is talking about is Mordechai, because of verses 2 and 3. Now, Haman does not realize that. Vayomer Haman belibo. Haman says to himself, L'mi achbot hamelech la'atzot yekar yotai mimeni. Who would the king desire to honor more than me? Haman thinks Ahasuerus wants to, you know, give some sort of special, because in Haman's head, Haman is the most important person ever in the world. And the mere fact that he was asked what should be done to honor someone whom the king, you know, wants to give special honor to, he thinks it refers to him. Now, what is blatant from this chapter is that a lot of what happens next is played out for comedic effect. the whole grand switcheroo. It's funny. So it's actually from a, again, if we weren't so conditioned to the story and the language and style weren't a barrier, we would recognize that this is a funny situation that's about to happen with the grand switcheroo. Hammond's about to go describe all of these grand things, only to be told his enemy, the person he hates, because we've been reading about the whole time, because something else just to point out about the Megillah, which is, again, a cool thing I spoke about last night about, from a halachic perspective, being prepared for the Megillah reading so that you can appreciate it the next day. Again, something to recognize about the Megillah is that it's one of those stories where you have multiple different characters, each going about their lives, that keep on meeting up at various points. Mordechai and Esther, Mordechai and Haman, Achashverosh and Haman, Achashverosh and Esther. All of these, Mordechai, Haman, Achashverosh and Esther, are all kind of doing their own thing and keep on meeting up. So again, if this were a TV show or a movie, the Haman storyline, the last thing Haman had been doing was obsessing over Mordechai. Meanwhile, Ahasuerus has been doing all of this stuff. But now we're coming back to the obsession with Mordechai. And again, the comedic relief is that, or the comedic point is that Haman's actually going to, who he's obsessed with, he's now going to have to, you know, lord him. But what we fail to recognize because of that is this other thread to the story, which is Ahasuerus is triggered. He is suspicious about Haman, and he asks Haman, what should be done for a man whom the king desires to honor? Now, Ahasuerus is asking, in part, because he does want to honor Mordechai, but I think it can be very much viewed as a test of Haman, because he knows Haman, you know, sees himself as important. It's a pretty obvious character. You know, the Megillah kind of hits us over the head with how the characters of the Megillah are not subtle. Like they're not, you know, like, it's very obvious Haman is, you know, an ambitious, you know, politically climbing individual. Such people are usually pretty obvious and transparent. And again, Ahasuerus might have his failures, but you don't become king of 127 provinces without having a little bit of political acumen. Even more so, if we assume, you know, if we understand the story, Ahasuerus's rise to power, the way Chazal read it, as him himself usurping the throne, again, Ahasuerus still has political chops. And he asks Haman what should be done. Haman responds fascinatingly. Verse 8. And again, we'd spoken about this bit in the Shir last year. Yaviu levush malchut asher lavash bo hamelech. Wearing the king's clothes that have been worn already by the king. Asher rachav alav hamelech, vesus, riding a horse that has been ridden by the king, and on whose head a royal diadem is set, and let him be paraded through the city. This is what's done for a king, for someone whom the king desires. Haman's suggestion is, how do we honor the king? You cosplay as the king. You dress as the king. More specifically, you wear the clothes the king himself has already worn. Now, let's think about this for a second. So I will use a sports analogy. I'll specifically use a soccer analogy. The fact that you can see behind me, I have a giant, you know, it's not actually a soccer jersey, but it's like a picture of a soccer jersey. You know, some people like to buy soccer jerseys with the names and number of the player on the back. One could argue part of that is not just because it's your favorite player or you like that player, so you want to have their name and number on your back, but there is, especially for kids who like playing soccer, they specifically choose a player they wish to imbue, they wish to embody. You know, I want to be, you know, very rarely do people buy the jerseys of the competent but not particularly exciting player. You always buy the player who's like the exciting one, the highly regarded one. That's how it works. Imagine the power of a soccer jersey worn by a player. These are usually given away as part of charity. But a soccer player wears a jersey to a match and then takes off the sweat-ridden jersey he's just worn, and you can win that. Imagine And again, maybe it's hard for you to imagine if you're not particularly into sports, but, you know, imagine wearing that jersey. Imagine, you know, your favorite Broadway musical. You don't just buy the costumes of the characters. You can wear the actual costumes worn by the musical people, singers, people, actors, whatever you call them. They also sing. So what's an actor who also sings? I don't know. But there is an additional power to wearing something worn by someone already. It's an added level of investiture. What Haman asks Ahasuerus to do is play king for a day. And with this, he reveals his ultimate ambitions. Haman is not going to be content to be second in command. He's ambitious, Ahasuerus knows it. And now, given the chance with his guard down, because Haman himself is a little bit overexcited, he asks Ahasuerus to be made into a mini king. What does Ahasuerus do? He says, do it to Mordechai. Fine. And then comes the comedy. Then comes the grand reversal. Haman's a little like confused. Haman's a little, you know, upset. But Haman has now unintentionally played his card. And it's a card that Esther has been priming Ahasuerus to detect. Ahasuerus, who is already triggered at this point. All Haman has done is underscore, you know, the siren has just cranked up another level now in Ahasuerus's mind. Haman has been elevated by Esther, and Haman is revealing himself to be a threat to Ahasuerus. Chapter 7, they both go. Again, Ahasuerus really, you know, really not, you know, not doing well here on the whole maintaining calm. Once again, verse 2 of chapter 7, once again repeats as Esther, whatever you want, I will give you. And this is when Ahasuerus asks, you know, this is where Esther tells Ahasuerus the problem. And Ahasuerus, It is interesting the words used by the Megillah here. Again, I'm always worried sometimes of overreading things. So verse 4 ends with Esther saying, someone's trying to kill us. Vayomer Hamelech, the Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus responds. Okay, the English translates in here, JPS is demanded. But Vayomer in the Hebrew is an ostensibly relatively neutral word to convey speaking. Vayomer le Esther Hamalka, mi hu zeve ezahu, who is this person? Asher melaol libola asokin, who dared to do this, whose heart has been filled with the will to do this. Vatomer Esther. Esther responds, ish Sarva Oyev, the enemy, the adversary, Haman Haraza, this evil Haman, and Haman cringes. V'hamelech kam b'chamatom mishtei hayay. Ahasuerus then does something really strange. El ginat habitan. He just storms out of the room. In his fury, Ahasuerus is unable to even remain in the room. It is the strangest of reactions. Unless, I would argue, when do you get up and leave a room? When do you get up and seek space and fresh air? When you need to process things? Because for Ahasuerus, and this is, I think, something important to stress with the whole, like, Vayomer HaMelech. Ahasuerus seems relatively chill about the whole someone's trying to kill the Jews. And learning the new information that it affects Esther, he responds. But his response is relatively neutral. And this makes sense, because when Ahasuerus was first proposed, when Haman first proposed to Ahasuerus to murder all the Jews, Haman was pretty cool with it. He didn't object. Ahasuerus was pretty cool with it. He didn't object. Ahasuerus has no qualms with Jews being exterminated. He doesn't really care. What bothers him is not the extermination of the Jews. What bothers him is the fact that it's Haman. It's the anger of Haman. Ahasuerus does not like Haman. Ahasuerus sees Haman as a threat. And now Haman has been thrown into the limelight as an enemy of the queen. Until now, Ahasuerus has been worrying why Esther has been lining up Haman as such an important person. And now maybe he even realizes and recognizes she's setting up Haman here. That's actually kind of convenient for Ahasuerus. If Haman is being set up as he now has a convenient reason to do away with Haman, who he doesn't like, he's now being given a politically positive reason to do away with Haman. What's crazy is, this is really telegraphed to us pretty explicitly with verse 8. So Haman is pleading with Esther to save his life. Please don't do this. Please don't do this. The Hamelech, and again, it should just be noted, the notes here, the trop, really extend this, prolong this scene, which is, again, something as I've been learning to lay in Megillat Esther, something I'm really coming to appreciate is just how much drama is conveyed by the tune itself. It really drags out the... admittedly, I'm a fast laner also, so I might say it also speeds up the boring parts, but I think that's just me speeding up the boring parts. But it definitely drags out the drama. V'hamelech shav miginat bitan el beit mishtei hayayin. Those, however many words that are, take an age to say because all of those notes are ridiculously long notes to pull off. They will take, when we come to Megillah reading, make a note, chapter 7, verse 8, it's going to take a disproportionately a long amount of time to read verse 8. Each one of these notes is surprisingly long. What is happening to Haman at this point? So the king comes back. He's still angry. V'haman nofel al mita asher Esther alaha. Haman is lying on Esther's bed. V'yomer hamelech. Hagam lichbosh et hamalka im iba bayit. Do you mean to ravish my queen in my own house? In other words, is your desire, and again, this is Ahasuerus now, the red mist has descended. He sees Haman lying on Esther's bed and doesn't think he's begging for mercy, and he thinks this is an attempt. What do you do when you usurp the king? You take his wives. This is a recurring theme throughout Tanakh in many places in the ancient world as a whole. You take the king's wives as your own now. That indicates your power, your domination over the previous king. You now have his everything. Ahasuerus sees Haman on. And it's like, you also are wanting to take my queen in my own house. In other words, is that the extent to your usurping? And then no sooner do these words leave the lip, Ufnei Haman Chafu, the face of Haman was covered. What does that mean? Someone sticks a sack over his head. The secret service have come in. The secret police have come in. Take Haman off, and then he's going to get himself killed. It should also note, and I don't kind of want to dwell on this again, but I don't want to look at this in the text itself. Ahasuerus is still pretty reluctant to, you know, there's a whole, oh, it's a king's decree to, actually, let's look at this. Because I think this is important to underscore my point here, which is that Ahasuerus cares far more about getting rid of Haman than the Jews themselves. Verse 8, blah, 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 blah. He gives Haman's stuff to Esther and Mordechai. Esther goes back, verse 3 of chapter 8, She's begging, remove the decree of Haman to exterminate the Jews. And basically, if we read these verses, Ahasuerus is like, look, I've got rid of Haman. And look, you can write a letter to say that the Jews can defend themselves. Like, that's his way of solving the problem. Now, I know the whole story, the king can't, you're going to tell me, oh, but we already know the king can't overwrite his own decrees. So tell me this, answer me this, if you really believe that. Have we seen anything in Megillat Esther until now to teach us that Ahasuerus follows the rules of his kingdom? No. He's chomping and changing his decrees the entire time. He's changing laws this way, that way. He does whatever he pleases. Oh, but now, when he's asked to save the Jews, he's like, well, I can't really change my rules. But you know what? You can write a counter letter that you can defend yourselves. Ahasuerus doesn't care about the Jews. But they gave him a politically convenient reason to get rid of Haman. And Esther knew, and I think this is an important point to kind of stress. Esther knew this. I'm going to stop scrolling. I'm stopping the screenshot at this point. Sorry, I was absentmindedly scrolling through Megillat Esther. But we don't necessarily look at Esther through the lens of a politically calculating person, but she is. How she picks up on this idea, if it's natural to her, if she's learned it, I don't care, I don't know. But she realizes that Ahasuerus doesn't care about the Jews. She knows him. She understands him. She knows what life in the court is like. She knows the only way she's going to get rid of Haman is by making Ahasuerus get rid of Haman for his own reasons. She plays Ahasuerus and Haman off one another. She takes advantage of Ahasuerus's insecurity and Haman's transparent ambition and plays the two off one another. And again, this is not necessarily unfamiliar to us, but when we actually, again, when we listen to the Megillah, we're trying to get through it as quickly as possible. But when we actually digest the narrative beats of the story and we read it slowly, we start to try and picture it as a movie in our head. There's almost a fun exercise. Write the Megillat Esther movie. And you have to make some editorial choices. There was a person who used to make this point regarding other stories in Tanakh. Try to make this into a movie and you understand why Midrashim are so important. You have to decide. Going back to last week, you have to decide the kind of Ahasuerus you're going to cast, the Ahasuerus you're going to write. If you make him too much of a buffoon, that automatically sets the tone for the rest of the story that you're going to read. If you're going to make Ahasuerus a powerful, calculating figure, that also changes things. If you're going to read Ahasuerus as a very politically astute, but nonetheless insecure, you maybe have to lean into that flashback at the beginning of the story where he usurps the throne. That explains why he's both politically calculating but also constantly insecure about his own position. But if you read it that way and you start to again make Haman into a very open about his ambition figure, then you start to recognize Esther too is playing these two figures off one another. And she is taking advantage of Haman's ambition, Ahasuerus's insecurity. And she's highlighting Haman's ambition in front of Ahasuerus. And then we read chapter 6, the pivotal moment. We didn't talk about the chiastic structure of the book of Esther, but just very quickly, we've spoken about them before. It's the idea that narrative units can be divided up into stories that mirror one another. So Megillat Esther is very transparent. The overarching theme of Megillat Esther, the Nahafochu, that everything is reversed. So Megillat Esther literally it completely pivots. And everything that follows, it doesn't divide into chapters. You have to look at it discrete verses or sections of verses. But what happens at the beginning happens at the end. What happens second to last. The pivot point is chapter 6. And that's the point where everything flips. That's where the reversal happens. But it's the decisive chapter, but we can also read it as a chapter which really plays off Ahasuerus's insecurity and Haman's ambition and how Esther works those two in order to remove Haman, recognizing that the removal of Haman is all that Ahasuerus cares about, but that allows her to also save the Jews at the same time. And I think it's a really fascinating way of reading the Megillah. It's a really interesting lens through which to read the story, and that definitely develops many different aspects to the narrative as we read Megillat Esther.